Dargrave Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. Autumn Semester 2009. This is Business Finance FIL 240, Section 6. Lecture 1, delivered on August 18, 2009. The title of this lecture is Introduction to Finance.
Today, Introduction to Business Finance. Business Finance is the introductory course here at Illinois State University to the discipline of finance. Now, finance in our view has three major areas. The first area is managerial finance. That's what I am going to focus on in this course. Managerial finance, the nitty-gritty nuts and bolts financial management as an integral part of the firm. Second aspect of the discipline is money management, capital management, if you will, handling the flow of money in and out of the financial markets. Banking would be in that sector. Actually, there are some liaisons in a company that deal with the capital markets, too. The third area of finance is investments. That would be stocks and bonds, all kinds of weird kinds of instruments that you might have heard of, like derivatives, options, futures. Now, the truth of the matter is, and the textbook actually makes the lines a lot brighter. In reality, and I'm speaking here from experience, these lines bleed a lot. Someone who's a financial manager in a company who's analyzing cash flow patterns and projecting and all that might also be very much involved in how the funds are raised from the capital markets, the interaction with investors, the interaction, the understanding of what is possible in terms of raising capital. I've got some incredible ideas. $1 billion, that's all. You know, I've worked out the numbers. I'm good at that stuff. Now, I'm going to need that $1 billion, okay? Well, you know, it's not going to happen, okay? It just isn't. You see, because there you have to understand not just the cash flow patterns of your brilliant ideas or someone else's brilliant ideas they brought to you, but you also have to understand how capital markets work, what is feasible, what those capital markets, their current condition, has as an impact on your analysis. The interest rate environment is going to heavily affect the cash flow pattern, its value, and all of that kind of stuff, the economic environment. So, and also investments. Look, a company really is little more than a synergistic portfolio of investments. Every product that a manufacturer makes, every service that a company delivers is an investment. It has an initial cost. It probably has maintenance costs. It has cash outflows. It has cash inflows. It behaves according to the same rules as a stock or a bond. I would analyze the value of a stock in exactly the same way that I would analyze the value of a project, of a new product line. I would do it the same way, using net present value, using the capital asset pricing model to find a discount rate to use on the cash flows. So realistically, these lines are blurred all the time in the market. They really are. In the real world, I should say. So when I say this bright line, financial management, capital markets and in investments. That's sort of like just for quick lecture purposes. I might do say it that way too. I might leave it that way for students who are earlier on in their college education, but I can't be disingenuous with you about that. Now, what we do in finance, and I don't want to have a fight with any textbook that I use, and this is actually a decent textbook, but I've got to take an exception here. Look, we are economists at our heart in finance. We're just technical economists. As a matter of fact, I am an online publisher. I write, I publish. I write a lot. I write hot subjects that are hot and interesting, subjects that are arcane and boring. But I call myself a financial economist because that's what I am, because finance and economics are so interrelated. Unfortunately, economics until recently ignored its financial aspects. Finance, a little bit more honestly, understands its economics background. We do economics. We look at the world as economists, and we apply technical formulas, methods, and thinking that are useful in the business world. That means that when I ask some questions here in the next few minutes, I'm going to be probing you on your knowledge of economics as much as I am on any knowledge of finance. I can teach you the finance. I have to have you know the economics. And to the extent that you don't know the economics, I'm going to get you up to speed on some of the absolutely necessary concepts of economics. The textbook says that finance is a combination of economics and accounting. That's not good thinking. Yes, we use accounting information. We have to. But accounting information is historical information. We cannot care about history. We have to care about what is out there. History is gone. You made an investment of $100 5 years ago. Now, when you are looking at whether to buy or sell your stock today, how does that $100 play in?
It was your initial investment.
Yes. What does it matter to today's analysis of whether to buy or to sell?
You want to have more than $100 if you want to sell.
Okay, I'm going to tell you a secret now, and that's why you're in this class. $100 doesn't mean a thing. It doesn't. You see, that $100 is gone. It died. It went home, and now it's with Jesus. It is no longer there. You can't show me that $100. It's away. Accounting is about, it has to be about documentable historical numbers. But when I'm looking towards the future, you see, all I care about as far as a buy or a sell, a hold on that stock, is what its expected future payoff to me is going to be. Nothing about the past is mattering. Take it this way. Think about it this way. Madam, you're in the library and you get lost up in the ugly, dark, musty old newspapers. You go into this room. You hear sound. You know what EVPs are?
No.
Electronic voice phenomena. They do it on ghost hunters. They hold up and they hear these whispers of ghosts. You hear those. They're going, rah, 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 sis, boom, bah. That's the old school spirit, you see. But then you stumble over some newspapers and you open one up and, my God, this is from like the 1940s. The business section. Listen. Well, here's a company. It says it's developing a new kind of computing machine. And this thing looks really cool, hot. Hey, they're thinking of changing their name to IBM, International Business Machines, and they're talking about something called a computer. Well, you're going to say to yourself, well, spank me Jesus, I've got to go and call my broker and tell him to buy some of that there IBM because they're working on a computer. What's the matter with thinking that way?
You don't think it's going to go very far?
Well, why not? I mean, you're obviously reading a paper from 1940 about a new innovation called a computer made by a company called IBM. So you've got to get in on this hot, hot investment. So you're going to call your broker. Again, what's wrong with calling your broker and acting on that information you read in that newspaper from 1940? It's too late. Don't you hear? It's too late. That computer has already been developed. Any information that would have been in that story has already been impounded years and years ago in the price. That information is irrelevant to right now. It's completely irrelevant to right now. Nothing about the past is going to tell you about the future of that stock, IBM, because the information has already been brought into every investor on earth already knows about IBM, already knows about the computer. That's useless information. It's even worse than that now. Unfortunately, it's not just all past information, but in some capital markets now, ungodly weird stuff, it's future information already known. Goldman Sachs is pulling one of the creepiest ass tricks I ever thought I'd see in finance. They're actually looking forward a few microseconds into the future, and they're able to beat everyone to the trades because they can see just a little window a few microseconds ahead of the market. Now, that's creepy. That gives you an idea of how useful historical information is going to be. It's not that useful. But we have to use it. We have to use it so that we can try to identify trends and things like that. So we are going to use accounting information, but I do not want to emphasize accounting information too much in this class, in the sense that we have to do more than just look at accounting numbers. We have to think about the economics of situations. We have to think about future expectations instead of past experience. Past experience helps, obviously, but it cannot be our sole guide to what we are going to make as decisions that will affect the future. Now, I'm going to let me beat on you for a second. What's opportunity cost? If you don't know, this is okay to say.
It costs like going to school is an opportunity cost instead of like working.
You gave me an example. Can you? That's okay. You're actually, the example is valid, but I still need to know if you know exactly what it is.
Is the cost of doing something?
The cost? No. Oh. You're almost there. It's the cost of the best alternative you didn't do, the cost of the best foregone alternative. In this classroom, the cost of the tuition and fees is minimal compared to the opportunity cost of the time you're spending here instead of out working. You, woman, could have a job, $10 an hour, okay, $8 an hour. No, not you, the economy, you understand, mind you, that was... The fact that you are in this class, what, 3 hours a week, and you should be studying 2 hours a week outside of the class for every 1 hour in class, that's going to put, what, 16 times, geez, that's a lot of, times 9? I so suck at arithmetic. 4. I can do it. Get off me, okay? 144 hours. Let's say it's $10 an hour for that. That's $1,440 in foregone money. Well, you're saying, I wouldn't have been working. I would have been at home. Nevertheless, you would have still been giving up. That's your opportunity cost. More than a few years back, when I was at a private college here in this town, I won't mention its name, they brought in, well, who, the person who was the mayor of the town at the time, of the big city next to our city, and she was pushing her dream of an arena, a sports arena. My God, all my students, my business students, all came in there, and they all sat there very properly. They're all perfect yuppies, you know. They all look perfect, you know, when they're out in public, and then they're dropping acid when they're at their doors. I shouldn't be saying, God, this is a podcast. But there she was, and she brought her city manager, the financial analyst, in tow. He was on a leash. Come, boy, sit. And after she had gone through all the incredible things about how wonderful this arena would be and how they'd be able to sell tickets to people in this 60-mile radius around, who am I kidding, we're talking about, around the city. Then he comes up there and he starts talking about the numbers. Well, I'm going to blow these finance kids away in this class. He went through it, and he went through all the analysis. Here's the cost of this. Here's the cost of this construction, all this. And he said, are there any questions? And those students just sat there. But they were bright, just like you are. Once you get a little background. And I could tell there were a few who were a little uncomfortable with something was wrong, and so no one would say anything. Of course, all the other professors were there saying, just sitting there saying, when's dinner? And I go, excuse me, where's the cost of the land? Oh, we already own the land. I looked at him right in the eye, this little greasy guy. I said, you own the land. He knew right then and there that there was no inclusion of the cost of the land in the project. Well, why would you include the cost? Because what can you do with that land if you don't use it for that project?
Other things.
Like what? Like sell it. Like rent it to someone who could actually run an arena, for God's sake. You see, it was a cost, regardless of whether you own it or not, it's a cost of the project. In finance, we cannot look at just accounting numbers. We have to look at the economics of opportunity costs. If I take your butt off one project and put you into a new project, you become a cost of that project.
Well, we already have you as an employee. You're one of our slaves.
No! You are a cost because I've given you up where you were to put you over there. You are a cost of the project. That's how powerful economics is. Just like, look at that number right there, $1,440 just for this class is your opportunity cost. Notice how that dominates the tuition and the fees for the class. That's going to be true throughout finance. It will be those hidden costs, those indirect costs that will bite you in the ass. And that's why a lot of projects fail is because they don't look at the opportunity costs. They just go with the direct numbers. Well, here's our cash flow from revenues. Here's our cash flow for expenses for getting this project underway. And then they say, is this a positive net present value project? Go with it. And then later, what the hell happened? Because they didn't do the analysis right. You see, we don't need to talk about things like ethical backgrounds. We need to talk about thinking out of the box. No, think in the box. For God's sake, know what the box looks like. You'll find out there are some pretty mysterious places in there, like opportunity costs, indirect costs. And on the other side, there are also revenue streams that are not even visible from projects sometimes. Charitable works, they're just costs to the company. So why in the hell would you do something good for the community? Well, it's all about the stakeholders. Oh, the hell it is. It's about making people feel good and gooey about your company. Really? When we do these things, we want people to like us. And then they have a favorable impression of us, and they have a favorable impression of our products, and then they're more likely to go out there and buy our products, and they're more likely, and they are less likely to believe someone who doesn't like our products. Come on, let's get real about why we do things. We don't do things for the love of the world. In economics, we assume that everyone is rational, and rationality drives action. I've got two grades left. I've got an A and an F. And you're my last two students that I got to give. Which one? Okay, I see you first. Which one do you want?
The A.
You greedy bastard.
Thank you.
What about this? We are all one. Hold hands and sing "We Are the World." Oh, you're looking at me like kiss my ass. Yeah, I'm not going to do that. Not if it's my A. She could go burn in hell. You see, that's the way it works. But that is what is good about economic thinking. Greed is not bad. Greed is good. Greed works. Greed creates efficiency because if you can make the product better than him, you're going to do it. And you are going to offer a lower price. Why? Not because you love yourself, them customers, but because you want to take his business away, drive him out of business, put him into bankruptcy, and make his kids go to Illinois State University. Oh, God. You see, greed doesn't hurt. It is when greed becomes toxic. It is when greed is not to the purpose of driving efficiency. And this is part of economic thinking. I want you to think in economic terms. Rationality. Look, you know that you're a bread maker. You two are making bread. You find a better way to make the bread. Let's say you just using your resources more efficiently. You can bring it down your cost. That's static efficiency. Then you come along. He's making money. He's not the kind. He doesn't deserve money. So you figure out a better way to make the bread, a new technology. That's dynamic efficiency. None of you are doing this for the world. You're doing it for yourselves. Now also think about this. You've got yourself this bread. You're making it. Now I want you to think about putting a sign up above your store. My bread tastes like ass. No one's going to buy your bread if it tastes like ass. Mommy tries to bring her kid. No, Mommy, I don't want that bread. That bread tastes like ass. Oh, shut up. There are kids starving in China who'd love to have an ass sandwich. You're not going to sell it if it's ass bread, unless you're really good at niche marketing. You got to sell a product that doesn't kill your customers and doesn't make them have ass breath. Okay? The point I'm making here is that greed is not a bad thing. Greed is a good thing. It drives efficiency as long as it does not go toxic and as long as it is to the purpose of making markets more efficient. You have to think like economists about opportunity costs, about hidden costs, about the rationality of markets, about the value of looking forward rather than backwards in time. That's economics. And I'll teach you that as I go along. I will keep referring back to economic principles, these fundamental principles of the rationality of action of agents, the value of assuming that people are greedy. You can't not assume that in the world of finance or in the world of business in general. And also, as we go forward, you'll learn technical stuff. You'll learn it. I'll make sure you learn it. If you don't, I'll drag your ass around the room until you do learn it. You'll get through this course, okay? I hope. I'm going to close the lecture here. That's all I have for you today in lecture. I thank you for listening.